Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
If you're into UFOs and aliens, the last 5 years or so have been fantastic.
Congress is investigating what they call unidentified anomalous phenomena. The rest of us call them UFOs.
After decades of public denial, the Pentagon now admits there's something out there.
Members of Congress on both sides of the aisle are pressing the Pentagon and other government agencies for more answers about UFOs.
A Pentagon report is detailing a dramatic increase in UFO sightings, more than 300.
Back in 2019, the New York Times published an article about reports of UFOs off the East Coast. It included several Navy pilots who witnessed and recorded mysterious flying objects.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My gosh.
If you haven't seen the videos, it's worth checking out. They are strange.
It's rotating.
I still haven't seen any evidence that actual aliens were involved, and that remains the least plausible explanation, in my opinion. But the story itself, that was a big shift in the public discourse around UFOs and alien life. The mere acknowledgement by the government that these objects were real was unprecedented. And the possibility that aliens might exist raises all sorts of fascinating questions. How would the discovery of extraterrestrial life change our world and our understanding of our place in it? And what if aliens are real, but so unlike anything we can imagine that we can't even begin to understand the implications? I'm Sean Illing, and this is The Gray Area. Today's guest is Diana Posuka. She's a religious studies professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and the author of two books on this topic. Her latest is called Encounters: Experiences with Non-Human Intelligences. Posuka has been studying UFO culture for roughly a decade now, and I think she's done the most compelling work in this space. And that's because it isn't really about UFOs and aliens. At least not directly. This new book dives more deeply into the experiences of people who claim to have encountered alien life. And those experiences, I assure you, are so much weirder than you think. They're also, as we discuss here, profoundly religious in their own way. Reading it, I kept coming back to that famous Werner Heisenberg quote, "Not only is the universe stranger than we think, it is stranger than we can think." Diana Posuka, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, Diana, it's a hell of a time to be on the UFO beat.
Yes!
Do you think we've reached escape velocity on this topic, and this is just going to be part of the public conversation moving forward?
Absolutely.
Well, so when you write in this book that UFO events are a spiritual reality, what does that really mean?
UFO events are transformative realities, not necessarily good. Religious events are sometimes bad and sometimes good. So I heard people talk about their experiences with UFOs, sometimes with, you know, what they called beings associated with UFOs, and they were having transformative experiences. And it sounded very similar to what I had been reading about in the Catholic historical record. I was finishing a book about the Catholic doctrine of purgatory, and I noticed that there were a lot of aerial events in the Catholic tradition, the historical record. There were no planes, there were no rockets back then, so people were seeing things in the sky, and they were interpreting them in various ways, one of which was, you know, these could be souls from purgatory, or they could be houses of saints and things like that that are up in the sky. And so when I say that we're dealing with something that I would call not necessarily a new religion. I would call it a new form of religion, a new form of spirituality, because a lot of people, when they have these events and say they happen to be religious, say they're Christian, they look at this and at first it challenges their religious framework. But then what they do, I noticed within a few months, sometimes a year, they reinterpret their own religion. They start to read the event back into their religion. So then you get the idea of like Ezekiel's wheel was a UFO, or what happened to Mary when Gabriel came and announced that she was pregnant, you know, that was a UFO type event and things like that. Muslims were doing this. Catholics were doing this. Baptists were doing this. Atheists were doing this, right? So I begin to see this as a non-regional form of religion.
I may end up repeating some version of this refrain several times in this conversation, but I just don't know what I believe with so much of this. One thing that's pretty consistent with so many people who report these experiences is that there's this psychic dimension. You know, people report having intuitions, experiencing bizarre synchronicities, visions before and after the encounter. And they seem to believe that these beings or these intelligences are able to communicate with them telepathically. You know, like that these things, whatever they are interdimensional. You know, they're here and not here, or they've always been here, just outside of space-time. And I sound like I'm cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs just describing all of that. I don't even know what half those words mean, but that's accurate, right?
Yes, but you have to understand that that's not actually very new. Maybe the framework of science and kind of outside space-time is new. But what struck me when I began this study is, first of all, every religious tradition that I study, practitioners talk to me about synchronicities, meaningful synchronicities. So they could be Catholic and they say, I was converted because something happened and it was obviously meant to be because it was so coincidental, it was improbable. So when I talk to people who are experiencers, people who experience UFO events, they had the same language. So I suggest that synchronicity or these meaningful coincidences, this is the engine of spiritual belief. It's not just within the UFO community that people are experiencing their religiosity as this moment about these beings that seem to have telepathic abilities and people experiencing telepathy with them. You see this in the history of religions. You know, when a person meets an angel usually doesn't move their mouth when they're talking to a person. They just beam thoughts that these people understand. You do have very, very similar patterns within the historical religions.
You say that the UFO event is like a door that opens a person to a non-ordinary world. What does that mean exactly? It sounds like something you'd say about psychedelics.
Yes, it does. I think that when a person experiences the UFO, this is just from the data that I've seen, something shifts in them. This doesn't happen to everyone, but it does happen to many people. I think they don't take life for granted. They don't see it in the same way as they saw it. They don't make the same assumptions. And because of that, life becomes, they see it differently.
So when people tell you that they've, you know, encountered aliens or had been visited by angels in their dreams or any of these sorts of accounts, do you believe them? Or let me put that differently. Maybe that's the wrong question. Do you believe that they believe what they're saying?
I definitely do. So I believe that they believe it, but that doesn't commit me to believe that it happened. And I'll give you an example. Srinivasan Ramanujan is that very famous mathematician in the early 20th century. He's from India, and he was a genius. And he believed these math calculations were whispered in his ear by his goddess, the goddess of his local region. I think she was a version of Lakshmi. So, okay, when I start to look at that, there's this story that gets repeated. And so do I then, am I committed to believe that it was Lakshmi that gave, you know, Ramanujan that? No, I'm not. But I can definitely study that process, and I can study it in people today who say that they are experiencing aliens who are giving them this type of creative impulse. Some people say it was an angel that gave it to them. Let's study the process of it, and we leave aside that question of, does it actually objectively exist? Because there are a lot of things that you'll see that appear to be unbelievable. And you'll say, that's unbelievable. Because if I was a scientist, my mind would be shattered, I think, if I started to like get into this data. But as a person who studies religion, we're already studying things that people believe, but for which we have no evidence of.
Of all the interviews you've done with people in this world, all the stories you've read about, all the stories you've heard, what is the most mind-blowing thing you've encountered? I mean, what is the most kind of holy shit revelation or anecdote you've seen or heard?
I would say it would be the experience of a pilot who had a sighting while he was flying and then saw something that appeared to be like a human face. And then he started to see this person in crowds. He would also see UFOs in daylight, but he wouldn't tell anybody because, you know, he noticed that other people didn't see that. And he also had burns, like his eyes started to hurt. I asked a scientist about that and said, what's this effect, you know? And he said it was the effect of some type of radiation on his retinas. So that was pretty weird. I wouldn't want that to happen to me.
I don't think I'd sign up for that either. Some of these stories or these characters you profile in the book, I mean, it is just extraordinary that the vividness and some of the consistencies across these accounts, you know, like there's some part of me that cannot dismiss the thousands of testimonies of serious people. And it's hard to believe there's nothing to see here. I just don't know how much there is to actually see, but I don't think it's nothing.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I started out as a complete non-believer. And even though I'm not supposed to be, I actually was. And then when I met people who were in the space program or top researchers, one at Stanford, and there were so many of them, and I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. And that shock lasted for a couple of years. And, you know, I've been studying this now for about 14 years. So that's a long time. I actually believe these people. I also believe that there's a there, but I don't know what it is. And so it's definitely changed the way I look at the historical religions as well as the, you know, what people are talking about today.
So what's the there?
No, I don't know that.
Oh, come on.
So we're not there. We can only say that these people are having these experiences. Most of these people will not come out and say that they are because of their jobs. And you know, there's still a stigma, regardless of what happened with the New York Times, you know, coming out and talking about it. There's still a stigma. And I don't blame these people for not coming out publicly. And I'm not going to disbelieve them because I've met so many now, thousands of people who are credible witnesses. And the patterns are so similar too, that it leads me to then say, okay, you know, I am no longer that disbeliever. But then I don't know what it is either. And that's where we have to keep being credulous, you know, like, okay, we know that these people are having these experiences. We're not going to stigmatize them like, you know, what happened, you know, 10 years ago. But I honestly can't say that we know where we're at.
Yeah, you know, and again, I may sound like I'm contradicting myself, but I'm just being honest about my own ambivalence. You know, the will to believe the extraordinary is strong for sure, but so is the will to hold on to our current worldview. Because letting go of that means letting go of almost everything we take to be true. And that's scary. So there are forces pulling in both directions here, in the direction of belief and in the direction of disbelief. And I think, I don't know, maybe the only sensible position, at least at this moment, is agnosticism on this, just openness to the evidence, but, you know, remaining inconclusive.
Yeah, I do think that. I want to also push back on a little bit of what you say about, you know, the will to believe.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like most people don't want to see, like that pilot didn't want that experience. He didn't want to believe it. You know, if you're just going about your daily life and you have a pretty okay life, you know, it's not like you're looking for a UFO and you want to see it. And then all of a sudden it plagues you by appearing, you know, daily in the clouds, almost like mocking you. Like, who would want that experience? This is also the case with people who, say, see angels or see souls from purgatory in the 1600s or 1700s. They weren't actually looking for that. So, you know, I put one of those experiences in my book about purgatory. And, you know, it was this nun who saw an orb and it would come into her cell in the convent. And she was terrified, and she told people in the convent. Nobody believed her, but she kept her story. And finally, the Mother Teresa sat up with her, and sure enough, she saw the same thing. And so they then interpreted that orb as a soul from purgatory, and the whole convent prayed for weeks to get rid of it, and it finally disappeared.
I think that the skeptic in me will think the will to believe is so strong in the human mind. And we can convince ourselves of almost anything. And I believe that the people you write about in the book believe the things they're telling you to be true. But as you were saying, that doesn't mean they're true, or it doesn't mean that they're reliably true. You know, so there's that guy you talked to who moved his family out of LA to live in some remote town because he got a message from Jupiter telling him
to
do so, right? Like,
yes.
That could just be the hallucinations of a confused person. In fact, I'm pretty confident that it is, you know. So when you hear stories like that, what's your reaction?
I mean, what did the pilgrims do, you know, or what did people who, you know, had visions and thought that they needed to leave Egypt or, you know, go someplace, you know, because a god told them to, or because they had a vision from an angel that told them to do this? This is how I see that type of thing. I see it as a continuation of a process that humans have experienced for thousands of years, really. So it's a religious impulse. That's how I see it.
Well, for all the utility of science, it has gradually destroyed a lot of the spaces for mystery in human life. And to be clear, I think that's a more than fair price to pay for the benefits of science. You know, I don't want to live in the Bronze Age. I don't think anybody does. But there does remain this yearning for the unknown, for genuine awe. And I think I'm probably like a lot of people in that the closest thing I've had to a religious experience is an extremely heavy dose of psychedelics. And I'll just say that on the other side of that, I was much less certain of what I thought I knew. And all that stuff I had heard about, you know, some kind of higher consciousness, which always sounded like pure New Age dribble to me, suddenly felt like a real possibility. I mean, that's the only way I can relate to the stories you describe in this book, because I can't quite go full alien yet. I'm going to need more evidence.
I would push back on the idea that science has gotten rid of the mystery of life. The more I learn about science and the more scientists I meet, I mean, quantum theory is pretty weird. So the you know, once we start to study the universe, I met a lot of astrophysicists, and what they're doing is mind-blowing. The kinds of things like black holes that they're studying, the event horizon, I mean, that's a very strange thing right there, right? So it's not necessarily that the more scientific we are, the less of a mystery life is. I think the more scientific we are and the more we delve into the science, I think it's much more mind-blowing to us.
That's a very good point. The destruction of mystery as such is not really what I'm thinking about. And if it was, I was just wrong. I mean, if the images from the Hubble telescope don't invoke mystery and awe, nothing does. I think what I mean is that religion and mythology were really our first attempts as a species to make sense of the world, and science has undermined them in various ways, which has created a lot of tension, to say the least. But the mystery is still there. The awe is still there. Maybe we just need new language, new myths, new stories.
Yeah, I think that the instruments have changed. So we've developed instruments to allow us to like go to Mars and see what's there and to, you know, look at the strange ways that space-time bends and works in different places. And I think that this is awe-inspiring, frankly. I think it's really amazing. And, you know, it's just think about people 1,000 years ago and the ways in which they talked about the mystery, they tried to explain it. So I think that it's always the case that we're going to try to explain the mystery to ourselves. But I think that the more instruments we have in order to study the mystery, the weirder it becomes, frankly.
When we get back from the break, we'll talk about what extraterrestrial life would even look like. Stay with us. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. Have you ever had a hand-stitched pillow made especially for you, embroidered with the name Sean Illing? Or maybe someone just made you feel special by calling to say hello on my birthday. You don't always get this warm feeling in business, but NetSuite wants to change that with a cloud financial system specifically designed for your business needs. NetSuite can bring accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. They say you'll reduce IT costs because it lives in the cloud and cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems with one unified business management suite that brings all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And according to NetSuite, over 37,000 companies have already made the move. Why not make it 37,002? By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. You can head to netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area.
This episode is brought to you by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Choiceology is a show all about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Each episode shares the latest research in behavioral science and dives into themes like, can we learn to make smarter decisions? And the power of do-overs. The show is hosted by Katie Milkman. She's an award-winning behavioral scientist, professor at the Wharton School, and author of the best-selling book, How to Change. In each episode, Katie talks to authors, historians, athletes, Nobel laureates, and everyday people about why we make irrational choices and how we can make better ones to avoid costly mistakes. Listen and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or find it wherever you listen.
Support for this episode of Gray Area comes from Bombas. What's the last really nice thing you did for your feet? A pedicure? A soak in your criminally underused hot tub? Maybe just a tickle with your special feather? If the answer is none of the above, then you're not giving your tootsies enough love. Bombas can help with that. Bombas makes high-quality basics that bring a little luxury to your toes, like honeycomb arch support to hug your foot while you're on the move, anti-blister tabs to keep you pain-free, and cushioned footbeds to make each step more comfortable. You can try their socks or super soft t-shirts and underwear, knowing that everything Bombas makes comes with something no philosopher could possibly abide, a happiness guarantee. If you don't like your new clothes, Bombas will do everything they can to make it right. They sent me a few pairs of socks and a pair of boxer briefs a while back, and they're great. I'm not saying they fundamentally transformed my life, but I'm not saying that. You know what I mean? Anyway, you can get comfy this spring and give back with Bombas. You can head over to bombas.com/gray area and use code gray area for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/gray area and use code gray area at checkout. What is the best evidence you've encountered of, it doesn't even necessarily have to be alien life, but just evidence of something that you would call supernatural?
This is the evidence that we have first throughout the 1950s and 60s and 70s of radar blips and things that are on radar that go on and off that we can see. And then in that area, people will have seen what they then called, reported in a UFO, people who didn't even know each other. So it's these observational things with accompanying evidence of radar reports. I don't know what those are, though. Those could very well be advanced technology. But I have had people tell me, this is not our technology, and these are people that are supposed to know. When we see these things, those types of instruments, we also have people on the ground saying, oh, I saw a UFO. And this is well recorded.
Why, if aliens are real and they have visited in some form or another, why would they deliberately choose to reveal themselves to so few people instead of to everyone so as to remove all doubt? I mean, presumably, if they're advanced enough to get here or communicate with us, they could observe us without being detected. So why do it in this way?
If you have an education in the historical religions, you can see that angels work that way too. So they actually intervene in human history, apparently, for those who believe in them, but they don't do so on the White House lawn, right? They're not like, hey, God exists, you know, and you need to believe in God. They only do it to certain people, and then those people then tell others, and others believe or disbelieve. So you asked me before, you know, how is this like a religion? Well, this is how it's like a religion. There are things that are based on faith. They're not based on something that we can replicate and show, like in a laboratory.
One thing that's clear reading this book is that there is a huge gap between the representations of UFOs and aliens in the press and in popular culture, and the first-person accounts of these encounters. Do you find that disconnect to be maybe the biggest obstacle to having a serious public discussion about what the hell is happening here or what the hell has happened?
This is something that a lot of people don't understand. When you see religious events from the past, that same disconnect is at play. So when people back in that time period saw something, they didn't understand what it was. So they had to look through their own cultural narratives in order to interpret it. And this moment was a moment of confusion. And then this confused the people around them. They said, I saw this. I don't know what it was. Help me out because it's freaky, right? And then the people around them were concerned and said, this seems like it could be this type of angel or something like that. Well, this happens with modern day UFO reports as well. What people see is definitely not what you see in, you know, Independence Day and that type of thing. But we have to represent it. So conventions then arise, right? And now we have this idea of this saucer type thing, this UFO.
Reading your book and listening to you now, I kept thinking about that movie Arrival. I'm sure you've seen it.
I love that movie.
For me, the smartest thing about that movie was its focus on the limits and possibilities of language and communication and how that might play out in the event of an encounter like that. But was that story, that scenario, the kind of thing the scientists in this book are thinking about?
I do think so. You know, when you do learn a different language, remember what happens to the main character in Arrival is that the way she thinks changes, the way she perceives time changes. And this is definitely what I see with people who do this kind of work, is that their perspective changes, the way they think even changes.
In what way?
Okay. So there's a researcher named Jacques Vallée, and he's been studying UFOs for, you know, his whole life, and now he's in his 80s. He talks about post-contact effects. So when people have experiences of things related to UFOs or something, you know, associated with UFOs, that they have effects. And one of the effects is that they perceive things like coincidences more often, and they also perceive time differently. So, you know, think about what a coincidence is. It, you know, Carl Jung said that it's something that has to do with a moment in time that seems as if you've been there before, right? It has this kind of deja vu experience where something that you're thinking about appears in your experience of time and also your experience. So these kinds of effects happen. And this is something that was related in Arrival as well. So yeah, so these kinds of effects happen to people.
What I really dig about this book, and I really enjoyed your first book as well, American Cosmic, but this one is especially interesting to me because it extends this conversation about UFOs and aliens to a broader exploration of all the possibilities of non-human intelligence, both terrestrial and extraterrestrial, and what it would mean to take that seriously. And it turns out a lot of scientists have been quietly taking this seriously. And I had never heard of this group called the Order of the Dolphin, which apparently included Carl Sagan, a hero of mine. And they were researching ways to communicate with dolphins, but was the real aim there to discover ways to potentially communicate with extraterrestrial life in the event of a real-world encounter?
Absolutely. I think that what they were doing, and by the way, I found out about this group when I was at the Vatican has an observatory, and the observatory is in Castel Gandolfo in Italy, right outside of Rome. And it's next to this volcanic lake. It's really a beautiful place. And they have an archive. So everything space-related goes to that archive. So I was in that archive, and I kept coming across references to the Order of the Dolphin. And I was like, who are these people? What are, you know, what were they doing? And so they were, of course, Carl Sagan was fascinated with the possibility of extraterrestrial conversation should that happen. They were basically trying to have a conversation with another species here on Earth to kind of get us prepared, but also because wouldn't that be a great thing to do? And scientists right now are utilizing different types of AI in order to interface with different species like dolphins or whales.
Well, you mentioned AI. I mean, if and when AI becomes truly sentient, or when AGI, as they call it, emerges, if it emerges, that would be an utterly alien form of intelligence. I mean, would that be much different from the appearance of aliens on Earth?
Well, you see, this is where I think it's really interesting. So two people of interest to me here in terms of how they view this. And one of them, he's former NASA historian, but he was a NASA historian and an astronomer for NASA for 40 plus years. And his name is Stephen Dick. He, more than 20 years ago, had postulated that if we meet ET, it's going to be a form of technology beyond AI to a different form of biotechnological evolution. That's why we can't see it, because, you know, we're looking for things that look like us, really. But why would we be doing that?
Well, that's what I love about this book. It gets you to think less and less about little green men and all that shit that we've inhaled through TVs and movies and that kind of thing. And just think more broadly about non-human intelligences, whatever that may be. And that's a different way to think about it. And the idea of technology as its own kind of alien life is really interesting to me. I haven't thought all that much about it, but it's interesting.
Yeah. A lot of the people who I know who have been doing AI for 20 plus years, this is what they think, that whatever it is that we're seeing in the sky is most likely a form of AI. And it is, you know, an evolved consciousness.
After one more short break, we get into the recent congressional hearings that might hint at alien life or something like that. Stay with us. Support for this podcast comes from another podcast. The world's most valuable resource isn't water or gold or even oil. It's data. Our data, based on our behaviors, is frequently being gathered, tracked, stored, and sold. These transactions are mostly invisible to us and worth billions. What does that mean for us? What does it mean for society? Join host Rafi Krikorian, Chief Technology Officer at Emerson Collective, for season 2 of Technically Optimistic, where he'll take you on a deep dive into how our data is being used and what we can do about it. How do we advocate for ourselves and our privacy so that we can have control over our information and a say in how technology evolves? From surveillance to social media, reproductive rights to criminal justice reform, Krikorian leads us into territories both familiar and unexpected with openness and genuine curiosity, encouraging us to remain technically optimistic in the face of big data. New episodes of Technically Optimistic drop every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
This episode is brought to you by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Choiceology is a show all about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Each episode shares the latest research in behavioral science and dives into themes like, can we learn to make smarter decisions? And the power of do-overs. The show is hosted by Katie Milkman. She's an award-winning behavioral scientist, professor at the Wharton School, and author of the best-selling book, How to Change. In each episode, Katie talks to authors, historians, athletes, Nobel laureates, and everyday people about why we make irrational choices and how we can make better ones to avoid costly mistakes. Listen and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or find it wherever you listen.
This is from your last book, I believe, but you were brought to an alleged crash site in New Mexico years ago. You were given rare access, and you encountered a material that did not appear to be of this world. Let's put it that way.
Allegedly, yes. So that is how I opened the book. So I was working with scientists, and one of them knew that I didn't believe at all. He said, I think that you think that people are seeing this in their imagination, but I want to take you to a place where, you know, I have some evidence, some physical evidence. And so I said, okay, where's that? And he goes, well, it's in New Mexico and it's a crash site. Now, this is, of course, a long time ago before any talk of crash sites. I mean, I thought that he was crazy. Honestly, I thought, okay, well, he's really smart and he has a really amazing job. And, you know, he seems like a normal person, but I thought maybe I was being given misinformation. There was definitely stuff out there, and it looked like it had been the site of some very important thing that happened, because you could tell that, you know, there was rubble everywhere and, you know, and it was really old. So I wasn't buying into the Roswell mythology, but I was saying that this is part of the Roswell mythology. And, you know, I'm here where people believe in this. And I'm just hoping that through my book, I'm not like reinforcing that belief, but that ship has sailed, you know, that's already been done. But it was at the time when the New York Times came out and said that there were these programs, and they, in fact, were crash retrieval programs. So inadvertently, I was doing this research, and this is what I found. It seemed like, you know, such a coincidence, you could say, that it came out right after the New York Times stories came out. But that was purely unintentional.
When those Times stories came out, and you know, obviously the Pentagon released those Navy videos, there was a lot of speculation that there has to be some reason for this. Why would they do it? And that perhaps it was, you know, part of some active disinformation campaign to muddy the waters for whatever reason. Is there something to that, in your opinion?
There could possibly be something to that. My own work is completely uninvolved with that, whatever is happening in Congress. I did a historical comparison between, you know, ascent narratives from history, Catholic history in particular, and modern day UFO reports. I stumbled upon a group that was studying UFOs. I wrote about that group. I believe that there's a continuation of experiences that people have that you can identify in the historical record for the various reasons that I've stated. So I guess I feel like I'm in a parallel research tradition to whatever's happening with the government right now.
Do you think that those, whatever that was in those videos, was an actual, I won't say alien craft, but crafts that defied the laws of physics as we understand them in the way that they appear to on the videos?
I think we have to be really careful about what we see these days because of deep fakes and everything like that. So I think that being very, very sober with respect to what we conclude about what we see is the best position to take. Okay, so I'm just going to give you an anecdote here, if that's all right, Sean. So when I was a child, my father had been in the Coast Guard, and he always had this story that he told in our family about something that stopped the ship he was on. It was called the Bittersweet, and he was the sonar man. The sonar kept going, and they were able to see something in the ocean, down at the bottom of the ocean. It actually stopped their ship, but all the electricity on their ship stopped, and it was terrifying. So this was an interesting kind of phenomena, you know, family history type thing. Well, I had forgotten all about it. And then I meet Tim Gallaudet, who is an admiral in the Navy. And he told me the very same story. Now, he didn't know that my father had this story as well. And he actually has data about it. My dad only had the members of his ship and, you know, it was only testimonial evidence. So I guess that what we have are credible witnesses, and we do have data, but I think that when we look at things on the internet and social media, that we should probably just be like agnostic at this point.
I should probably say that the government has not acknowledged the existence of aliens. It has simply acknowledged the existence of these unidentified aerial phenomena, if that's still the term we're using.
The name keeps changing. So it's unidentified anomalous phenomena now. And that's okay. Because I know. That's because they allow for transmedia. Like, you know, some of these things come out of the ocean and they're seen by people in the Navy.
What do you think this conversation around UFOs and aliens looks like in 10, 15 years?
Honestly, I don't have an answer because I feel like I couldn't have predicted what happened after American Cosmic was published in 2019. I couldn't have predicted that Congress would be talking about this, and I can only say that I think we're going to be surprised.
Tell me more.
Well, I was surprised. You know, I thought I had written this book and you know, I did the best I could in terms of the field research. And I said, look, you know, these people are studying this and they're very well educated and they're affiliated with our space program. And then the New York Times articles came out. And then before I knew it, there was the Pentagon report that talked about UAP. And the name UAP shifted a couple different times. And, you know, there was a constant conversation in Congress about this. So none of that I could have predicted.
I'm not even going to ask if the discovery of alien life would be the most significant event in human history, because it obviously would be. But I do wonder what you think the most significant implication of that discovery would be.
So for a person who has studied the historical religions, I would say that most people in the world believe in non-human intelligence because most people are religious. And so within various different religions, you have different forms of non-human intelligences that display themselves in different ways to people. So it's the people post-enlightenment in the West. We're disbelievers in that narrative. So it would be the most shocking event for us. And the implications is almost like a post-secular society.
What made the Copernican Revolution and the Darwinian Revolution so significant, not just scientifically, but culturally, is that they decentered humanity in the grand scheme of things. You know, Earth is not the center of the universe. Humanity is not a special animal with some unique significance. We're part of the same historical process as everything else. And the discovery of alien life, if it were to happen in a way that would be impossible to deny, that would be the final step in the revolution opened up by Copernicus and Darwin, and would, in a terminal way, I think, upend our sense of our own creaturely significance, which I think is a beautiful thing in some ways, but would be totally not worth it if the price of that discovery was aliens destroying us. Hopefully that doesn't happen.
Yeah, that would be a bad scenario.
I don't know. If you just look at the history on our planet, it's not a pretty picture when populations or species collide where there's a significant power or technological asymmetry. It tends not to go well for the side that's weaker. So that's a game I don't want to play.
That's right. That's right. I agree with you there.
You mentioned earlier that you started out, you know, as a typical academic skeptic, and I guess you're still agnostic on a lot of this stuff, but maybe I'm just trying to tease out as much as I can from you, but how has all of this research transformed you? Not just your worldview, but you as a person, really?
I have to say that it completely changed me. Like you said, I was a skeptic, and it took a few years to really shake that out of me. And, you know, it took a lot of meeting people like the admirals and the scientists and, you know, these people that I know. And then thinking back on, you know, things like the story of my dad and other people and what they've said, and then seeing the historical record as well. And so this shook me out of the assumptions that I had, and it made me think, okay, well, I actually don't know that much about this. Maybe I should learn. And so it put me into a space of questioning, and I've been in that space ever since.
I don't know what the threshold would be for you, but what would it take for you to step off the agnostic ledge and say, yeah, aliens are real? Is it a spacecraft landing on the White House lawn?
Well, something that was anomalous in 1952 did fly over the White House. So, you know, we do have that. And that's one of those cases that is still weird. What would it take for me to say, okay, aliens are a fact and they're real?
Yeah.
If they landed and we met them and they would say, okay, we'd like to give you this really awesome technology and your problems are going to be erased. And I mean, that's probably what it would take. Now, I would be very suspicious of them if they did that.
Why?
Probably because I've seen, you know, too many X-Files and Twilight Zones.
This stuff is so crazy, Diana. I don't know what I believe. I really don't. Other than it feels like a cop-out, but I don't know what else to say other than I'm intrigued, but I need more evidence.
I agree. And I think, you know, what's really interesting is that we don't have to be convinced to be completely interested. And we're going to find out more as time goes on.
Well, I've read your last two books and I enjoyed the hell out of them. And I'm just, I just think it's incredibly cool that you stumbled into this space as a scholar and you did it really at the perfect time. And now you've kind of become one of the point people for UFO discourse. So congratulations.
I don't know. I agree with you. I've become that person, but it wasn't intentional at all.
At this point, even if you want to do something else, I'm not sure the world's going to let you.
No, I don't think so.
Once again, the book is called Encounters, Experiences with Non-Human Intelligences. I read it. It is really terrific. I cannot recommend it enough. Diana Pasulka, thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. It was a great conversation.
All right. Aliens. Am I right? I don't know about you. I love this conversation. I love aliens. I love UFOs. I love all of it. And I think what I loved most about this particular conversation with Diana is that I think she has the almost perfect balance between being open-minded and skeptical, between genuine curiosity and also scholarly seriousness. And I think that's the right orientation to all this because it is kind of weird. And there is a lot of strange stuff going on, and I don't believe much of it, but it's worth taking seriously, and she does in a way that doesn't feel overly credulous. Let me know what you think. Drop us a line at thegrayarea@vox.com. This episode was produced by John Ahrens, edited by Jorge Just, engineered by Patrick Boyd, and Alex Overington wrote our theme music. New episodes of The Gray Area drop on Mondays. Listen and subscribe. The Gray Area is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep Vox free by going to vox.com/give.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot, because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.